The Future of Teamwork is a Leader production. Subscribe today and never miss an episode.
To make this assumption that anything involving emotions is only fit for HR or only fit for a therapy room is really doing a disservice to the people in front of you and the people who you are leading, because they are emotional beings. And so you can either figure out ways to work with that and to understand it and have the skills to work with it, or you can ignore it and just have it play out on its own, which often creates problems.
Welcome to the Future of Teamwork podcast. My name's Dane Gruneveld, and today I'm joined by Ashley Anderson. Ashley is the CEO and founder of Ezra Sage, and we've been having some great conversation around coaching leaders and teams through moments of change, particularly in being able to harness, you know, the emotional beings that we are. So we're excited to dive into conversation today. Thanks for being here, Ashley.
Yeah, thanks for the invite. I'm super excited.
We spent some time together, I think, initially on some conversations and then at the Healthy Team Summit. So it's kind of been fun getting to know more and more about you and your work. What can you share for the benefit of our listeners on sort of what brought you to this point in time and to this impact that you're having?
Yeah, likewise, Dane. And I still think about that summit, by the way. It was just so different from so many other events. And as I, you know, as we're kicking off the year and planning on going to all these other events, I'm like, I wish there were more opportunities like that, more intimate and really purposeful. So you are continuing to have that impact. But you said moments of change, and I kind of like laughed a little, because if only we lived in a world of like moments of change, right?
Yeah.
I think the reality that we all are experiencing is just like compounding change on top of change. And, you know, one's not even finished before the next one is rolling in. And that's our focus. You know, we really saw that companies had this focus, that the companies tend to focus on the tactical aspects of change, right? Like the strategy and the budget and the timeline and the stakeholders and whatnot. They're scrutinizing the numbers and like building the steering committees, and all of that is really good. And I'm not here to, you know, say don't do those things. But what happens all too often is that there's all the emphasis placed on that to the total neglect of the people. And the people are really the ones that are doing the change, that they're making it happen. Yes, it's in tandem with AI and machines and whatnot. But when the people get neglected in that way, that's such a detriment to the entire change process, because they do. They make it or break it, particularly the leaders. And what we know is that, you know, more often than not, it's not that companies are like completely neglecting people, but they're not shifting their approach and how they're leading people based on the number of changes that they're implementing. And I think if we all think about ourselves when we are forced to go through change, even when we're the ones like putting ourselves through change.
Yes.
We are different human beings when we're in a state of kind of chaos and uncertainty than we are when we're in a more sort of stable, predictable place in our work and in our lives. And the same is true when people are going through change in companies. And because of that, the way people are led through change needs to be different.
Yeah.
Because they're different. And that's essentially what we help with, is to help make sure that leaders have those expanded skill sets in the areas that are particularly important when you're talking about people going through change, people being, you know, soaked in uncertainty on a daily basis. And that's what we help companies with.
That's neat. I want to dive into that sort of chaos versus stable and predictable. But before we go there, what was it that brought your attention to this area of work? Was it your own experience in an organization, or some of your coaching work and how you were supporting other leaders? You know, where were those like formative moments of learning and affirmation realization for you?
Yeah, it's a great question because it's probably not exactly where you would think. But my interest, so my background is originally as a social worker. And I think because of that start in my career and that background, I don't know, chicken or egg, which came first, but I have an immense interest in like human beings and human behavior, but also human suffering. I that sounds weird to say I have an interest in human. It's intriguing to me about, you know, what is causing people's suffering in any given moment, what helps one person kind of prevail while the other person stays in that space of suffering.
Yeah.
And as we all know, if you haven't seen the headlines, there is a real epidemic around burnout happening in the workplace that's only been getting worse and worse year over year. And that was what originally caught my attention. And working with clients, I work with clients one-on-one. I do a lot of group work, teams, you know, workshops and programs. But no matter the setting, it was just like this unending suffering and burnout. Like there was no end. It was like, let's get through the pandemic and then that'll be better. And we got through and it was no better. It was just worse, right? So that was originally, you know, I thought there's a need here. But I recognized, again, maybe because of my clinical background, that burnout wasn't the problem to be solved, but that was a symptom. And so once we have a symptom, now we need to figure out what's causing that symptom. And there are a number of things that cause burnout. Rarely is it ever one, you know, particular situation or domain. But overwhelmingly, anecdotally, in my conversations with clients and friends, and then also digging into the research, what was revealed is that the greatest contributor to burnout right now is this constant change and the uncertainty that comes along with constant change. And so that's kind of the connecting the dots to why we do the work that we do on really helping, you know, leaders become change ready.
Brilliant. This whole sort of chaos stress response, constant change, you mentioned earlier, like unfinished cycles of change. I've heard Andre Martin, a good friend of mine, talks about some of the research that he studied for his book on, you know, burnout follows an incomplete stress cycle. So often a project has a beginning, middle, and end, but if a project has a beginning and middle, and then all of a sudden it's merging into other projects, you're never really having that moment of completion or grief or excitement or reward and celebration or whatever it is. So it's just like you're in constant stress response state.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would add, it's less so about the like the project completion, although that is an important process, and more so about the emotional circle and cycle. And you brought up, I think you just brought up grief. I might have been wanting to hear that word come up, but that's one of the big emotional experiences that's happening in the workplace these days that nobody wants to talk about. And I get that because, you know, most people don't study that in school, don't get training on that. And so it very much feels like, oof, who am I to touch that? And so we see a lot of leaders kind of deflect and say, oh, that's for HR, or here's your EAP. And certainly it's great to lean into HR partners and to know your resources like your EAP, but not every you know, case of grief needs an EAP intervention. You know, sometimes it just needs to be acknowledged and recognized and honored and validated. And grief doesn't have to be about, you know, this great huge loss of life, which we often relate it to. It can be, you know, your good buddies that just got laid off or, you know, a project that's, you know, being deprioritized that you spent a lot of time on, a new, you know, operating system that like you used to know how to do everything, and now you're grieving the loss of that competency and knowledge.
Just a Microsoft update.
Just a Microsoft update. Yes,
it moved my favorite button.
Yeah. So we're emotional beings. I shared this quote with you from Antonio Damasio, a neuroscientist, that we are emotional beings who think sometimes, not the reverse. It's so true. And he's a scientist, so he knows, or was, I should say, but it's so true. And so, to make this assumption that anything involving emotions is only fit for HR or only fit for a therapy room is really doing a disservice to the people in front of you and the people who you are leading, because they are emotional beings, just like you're an emotional being.
Yeah.
And that's showing up every day. And so you can either figure out ways to work with that and to understand it and have the skills to work with it, or you can ignore it and just have it play out, haphazardly on its own, which often creates problems.
Big time. It's really interesting because there's a lot of pushback in society right now about woke concepts, woke behaviors, getting too fluffy or soft around humans at work. And yet, to your point, to where the research is suggesting, if we don't stop and think about the right acknowledgement or creation of space for emotions that do exist, then we are going to see unpredictable and adverse outcomes. And I think historically we probably have seen them and dealt with them in different ways. But I think now we're at this kind of crescendo where it's happening at a higher frequency, perhaps a greater weight of some of those unforeseen, unexpected moments if we're not making the time for the emotions to be, processed.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, looking at like comparisons of days in the past, our work is different today than it was before. It's with us all the time. For so many of us, we're never really disconnected from that work. We're certainly not mentally disconnected from it.
Yeah.
It's asking a lot more of us and occupying a lot more of our mental and emotional space. And we also have come to a place where we understand how much it matters to us, no matter what you're doing. Like your work is a significant way to contribute, to make an impact, to connect with the world around you and your community. And so I think we now recognize that it really does matter. And so we also expect more from our work. Mm-hmm. It's not just like, oh, just give me a paycheck. It's we want more from that relationship that we have with our work. And so, I was talking to somebody recently that was talking about different generational needs and desires from their work settings. And they're trying really heavily to appeal to and recruit younger folks into their workforce.
Yeah.
And this person was having a conversation with the CEO. And fortunately, she has a lot of influence over the CEO, because the CEO was sort of like, well, if they don't like the way we do things here, then they don't have to work here. And she was like, well, we actually need them to work here. Like, we are just looking logistically, like, we're going to lose a huge batch of people. We also need that innovation and that creativity and that knowledge that other people don't have. And so we do need to change how we are operating. It's not enough to just put it on a job description and or on a value statement. Like, we actually need to look at how we're showing up each day and making sure that this is a workplace that cares, that really demonstrates that care for its people. And that can look different ways. But yeah, I think there's a variety of reasons why what worked yesterday is not working today.
There was a great podcast episode Scott Galloway put on. I think it was called Losing My Religion. It must have been 18 months ago. But to that point, it talked about in prior workplaces and like states of work, in our communities, we had the church or some other institution or organization to go back to where we got a lot of care or mattering, the work we were doing in our community besides our job. But that your point that work's always on for so many teams and this continuous change cycle, it's there's less certainty about what work's going to be in 3 months, let alone in 3 years, means that we're making less time for some of those community institutions and routines. And we are kind of going all in on work to provide a lot of what we need, which is kind of an inverse of some of the critique that leaders have said, hey, younger generations are expecting too much from work. They're expecting us to be doing their emotional regulation, this, that, and the other. It seems like there's two streams here. Like we've created a way of living that is so much more work centric right now. And you don't have some of that support infrastructure or social network around you to be going away and doing some regulation or doing some balancing, load balancing in.
Yeah. It's such a, I love that. It's like a sociologist's approach, right? Of like, why is this different? And I think that's such a healthy thing. We as humans, like, we tend to be pretty judgmental. And we see something that's different or that's frustrating, that's getting in our way.
Yeah.
And we judge it as wrong. We make it wrong. And it's easy to find the ways that it's wrong. But we can also choose to get curious about it and go like, what is that about? And why is that the case? And what might I be missing? And what's another perspective to this? And does that perspective hold value? And there's so much like empowerment that happens when you can just come from that place of curiosity rather than judgment. And, you know, certainly there are always going to be like the few that have people saying these blanket statements about certain groups of people, like in this case, generations. And are there young folks who are extremely entitled in the workplace? Absolutely.
Yeah.
Are there middle-aged folks and older folks that are extremely entitled?
Also true.
Also true.
Yeah.
Is it just the case that some people, you know, walk through life with this air of entitlement? Could that be it? And not necessarily have it just be. And there's that cognitive bias of, you know, what you look for, you'll find. And if you are looking for like the red Toyotas, now all of a sudden you're going to see red Toyotas everywhere. And so if you have made it your mission to find how terrible a certain group of people are, whether that's a younger generation or whatnot, probably going to be able to find evidence that supports that. But guess what? If you make it your mission to find ways that they're valuable and important to our workforce, you're going to be able to find that too. So it's like, which reality do you want to live in? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting on this, continue with this theme of like stress response, operating in chaos, how different people may need different things. There was also a podcast, Adam Grant and Daniel Kahneman, and Kahneman talked about it's hard to build happiness because happiness is so subjective. But one thing that is common across any generation, any person at any sort of stage of life or demographic or preference is that you can objectively reduce the misery of people on teams. And I'm hearing a bit of that in your work. You know, let's try and kind of create space, acknowledge what we're doing in the change process, think more about the people involved in the change. Because if you can reduce the misery through some techniques, I'm sure we can talk through a little bit more in a minute, then you probably are increasing energy levels, resilience, tolerance, innovation, a lot of the things that we really want to see happening in teams.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's interesting research. You should look into it if you haven't seen it already, from Sean Achor, Achor, A-C-H-O-R. He's out of Harvard and he's a psychologist. And he really looks at that concept of happiness and that it is about how you build adversity and how you get through hard things. And that's actually what makes you happy. We have this sort of over romanticized idea of like ease will make us happy. When in reality, it's being able to get through the difficult things. And of course there are things that are so difficult that they're going to be crushing, but we're really talking about run of the mill, you know, regular stress and pressure and chaos and uncertainty. But yeah, making things less miserable. I'm like, oh, I don't know if I love that. It doesn't sound as great, right?
It doesn't, but you shared at the beginning, that intrigue of suffering, in a lot of ways, that is.
It's reducing suffering, lessening suffering. And it doesn't, you know, I think sometimes as leaders, we can take on the weight of the world and look at everything as our responsibility to fix. And every problem is our responsibility to solve. And what we're trying to help leaders to understand is that, like, yes, there are certain arenas where your problem-solving abilities are very valuable. So don't get rid of that approach. But that's not the way to approach everything. So it's really important to be discerning with, like, what does this situation and what does this person need from me? And if you think about times in your own life where you've felt that, like, pain or stress or suffering, and I know suffering is a big word, but I think I use it because it is occurring all around us and in us on a regular basis. But if you think about your own experiences, what you need or what you needed wasn't this, like, huge intervention. You didn't need some huge solution to be thrown at you. You didn't need something that required a lot of resources, whether that's time or money. What you so often need is to be seen and to be validated and to be understood and recognized in whatever it is that you're going through.
Yeah.
And to feel not alone in it and not, you know, and to have some sort of counterbalance to this beautiful but wacky brain inside of our heads that tends to go to doom and gloom over everything.
Yeah.
You know, being able, and that's what leaders can provide to people, but it's not easy. I mean, it's not easy.
No.
It sounds like so simple, and it is simple, but simple isn't easy. And that's why it takes some work and some like muscle building for leaders to be able to show up that way, because it can be incredibly uncomfortable.
Very uncomfortable. Are there some key approaches that you're finding to be more effective right now when you're working with a leader to create that capacity to help people be seen, to feel not alone, to do some counterbalancing, you know, take the stakes away a little bit from the moment?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it all starts with themselves, as our work so often does. And really, a great place to start is, what is the emotion, or what are the emotions that you find really difficult to be with? And that's going to be different for everybody. Sometimes it's like sadness and that heaviness, that grief that we were talking about. For some people, joy is really hard to be with. And it's important for us to understand we all have this. It's not a flaw, but, like, we all have certain emotions that push a button in us that cause us to want to shut that down in ourselves and in other people. And so, as a leader, to recognize that is to then recognize, okay, these are the circumstances under which people might come to me, and I might have a tendency then to shut them down because that emotion makes me really uncomfortable.
Yeah.
So that's a really valuable kind of piece of self-reflection to understand about yourself, because it's going to impact how willing and able you are to be with that person when they come to you. Years and years ago, I was working with a big sheriff's office, and I was working with their sheriff's deputy, and he shared with me, he was great. He was, like, so open and, like, into the work. And he shared that he really can't stand to be with anxiousness, with people when they're anxious. And I was like, well, that's interesting. As a sheriff's deputy, how often are people anxious in your department? Like, all the time, right? These are folks that are dealing with some really high risk, high pressure situations. Of course, anxiety is going to be everywhere. And so the situation was, like, it wasn't that because he couldn't deal with anxiety, nobody felt anxiety. It was, oh, he can't deal with anxiety. Don't take it to him. And so then you had all his deputies who were just trying to figure it out. Yeah. Like they had no direction on how to really manage that particular emotion in a healthy, functional way. And so it was wreaking havoc within the department. And so it's just, you know, that's just one example of how when he became aware of that, he was like, oh, I either need to work on this on myself or to figure out how to give them that outlet because it's not me.
Yeah. I love that one. I've often found probably similar to that sheriff's deputy when someone's anxious or afraid or confused or whatever it is that they bring something to me. One of my challenges is I'm uncomfortable with that emotion. Mm-hmm. And so what I will often do to my detriment and their own is jump to fix rather than listen to the emotion and say, hey, it's normal to feel that way. And, you know, what might be causing that? How might you solve it? So rather than moving into coach mode, I move into like boss mode and I'm like, right, send an email to this person, ask them to give you this, and that should be fixed by Monday. But that's not what I'm here for.
But, it's Dane to the rescue, right? Well, and by the way, you and I would say like 99% of everybody else, especially if you are in a leadership position, because again, part of your job is to fix things, is to problem solve.
Yeah.
But it's about being discerning and it's about not just having that approach to everything and knowing when that's what's needed and when it's not. And what you're talking about, I would even challenge you, like before you go into coach mode, that the mode you need to go into is empathy mode, which isn't really doing much of anything. And that's, I think, part of the discomfort. You're sort of like, what am I doing? Like, if I'm not fixing, I'm not coaching, you're just being with them. And it's interesting. Empathy is this interesting skill because it's absolutely a skill. It's not one we ever learn, like concretely. It's so important. And if you ask a room of 100 people if they show up with empathy for their friends, family, coworkers, direct reports, 100 people will say they do. And the reality is that probably like 3 do. Because most people think that they're being empathic and they're showing up with empathy when they're doing exactly what you're talking about. But they're problem solving, they're cheering up, you know, they're going, oh, like, no, you're great, Dane. Like, it can't be that bad. No, or they're like painting the silver lining, like, well, at least this, you know, cheer up. Yeah. Or they're comparing, oh, that same thing happened to me and da, da, da. And those are all well-meaning. Absolutely, they don't come from a bad place. But what they do in one way, shape, or another is they kind of squash the person.
Yeah.
Like you're trying to clean up their mess. You're comparing yourself. So now you've sort of stolen the spotlight and they really needed that spotlight in this moment. You're telling them that it's not that bad. So you're kind of minimizing what it is that they're going through.
Yeah.
And it defeats the it's like the opposite of empathy.
Yeah.
And empathy is really just being with them and going like, that's so difficult. And even if you don't agree with it, like you might come to me and be like, oh, I had this terrible experience with so and so. And that, God, they're so rude. And I might love so and so. Never had that experience with them. What's my tendency going to be to go, that's not how they are. I'm sure they're just having a bad day. What does that result in for you? Like feeling squashed, your experience.
You're
is squashed.
Wrong or your feelings don't matter.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. So empathy is me like being with you in it and honoring your experience or your perspective as truth.
Yeah.
You know, not negating it based on my own. And then you don't have to like sit in it for 3 days together, like, you know, but you can eventually then move into coach mode. But that empathy
piece,
it's super vulnerable. It's super uncomfortable, but it's a skill and we can work on it and develop it and become more comfortable with it as long as we're practicing.
I love that. We had Zach Mercurio on the show the other day. He's just written his book, The Power of Mattering, and he and I were talking about skills decay in society right now. And I think that piece that you just shone a light on, the need to kind of start with empathy, we're not very good at that right now, because right now if you send me an email or a text and say, this has happened and I'm feeling really bad, I'll be like, send you a sad-faced emoji or a support emoji and be like, oh, that sucks. You know, I'm sorry you're going through that. You know, let me know where you land tomorrow. And that's just, we're not having the conversation. We're not having that moment to really create space or validate. And to your point, it doesn't have to be days long, but we need to rebuild that muscle.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so true. Again, it's kind of like this sociological perspective on it, and just thinking about like the way our communication has changed and how that impacts things like empathy or trust. It's fascinating to kind of go down that rabbit hole. And trust is another topic where we think, oh yeah, I'm building trust, but it's like, tell me what you're doing. Tell me the actions you're taking on a daily basis to build trust on your team, to build trust with your colleagues. And a lot of times we've got nothing, right? We talk about trust like in this nebulous way, like, oh, I'm building trust. There is trust, there isn't trust, but it's like, what's contributing to it? And I'm thinking, this is in my personal life, there was somebody who I just haven't heard from them, and they've been on some group texts recently and kind of been quiet. And I had this moment today where I was like, I should reach out to them. And then I was like, I don't really like have the time.
The energy. You know? Yeah.
I'm like, what am I going to open up? And you know, me, and it's probably fine. It's probably not that big of a deal. And how many times do we do that as leaders where we're like, maybe I'll reach out. Oh, I'm not going to. And then we get sucked into something else. And I did reach out, and they are going through a hard time. And no, not the end of the world, but they were super appreciative of just that outreach and that noticing too. Like they were like, thank you for noticing like that quietness.
Yes.
Which I think when we're moving so fast, we can really not notice those things. But those little signals and those little moments where we decide, where we choose, like I'm going to lean in.
Yeah.
They matter so much, and that's what's building trust. And so, you know, when we think about leadership, like how are you taking advantage of those little moments? Again, I think we can often make it out to be like, oh my gosh, I can't take my whole team on this retreat. We don't have the budget. We don't have the time. So you don't have to go on a 3-day retreat to build trust.
No.
Just check in when you get that little, you know, that little signal that you should check in. It's all these little things that add up over time.
That one's super powerful. And I saw recently Brené Brown on The Diary of a CEO. Did you see her Jar of Marbles? And that's exactly what she was talking about with her daughter. Like just that check-in is another marble in the jar, and it's the jar of marbles that's the trust. I think that's such a cool way, and it's so accessible for any leader to like just pay attention to those signals, as you suggest.
And it's I actually facilitate for her Dare to Lead work.
I'm
Dare to Lead facilitator. So I, as you're talking about that work, I got a big smile on my face because I love it. And a team I was on, we used to have like little jars of marbles on our desk just as a visual reminder of, you know, that all of our interactions can build or break trust. And you know, there are some things, especially when we're talking about change that is happening, like sometimes marbles are going to be taken out.
Yeah.
And you can do your best work as a leader to lead people through that change in a way that's really humane and kind. And marbles can still be lost.
Yeah.
And that's okay. They can be put back in. But what I always talk to leaders about is like, you can't wait until the moment that you need people to trust you to lean into that trust, because how do you know that there are going to be marbles in that jar?
Yeah.
You know? And so if it's empty and you got to do a hard thing that's going to take some out, now you're in the negatives. Versus if you have a jar full and you got to do the hard thing that's going to take some out, you can barely notice it.
Yeah.
And so that's why it's like, it needs to be built constantly or as early as possible and constantly and really checking in with yourself. You know, how am I doing this week? How did I do this month, this quarter? And building trust. Where having those conversations with your team?
Yeah.
Where do we stand as far as our trust levels and what do we need to be doing differently in order to keep building?
I love that. I wonder, it makes me think about sort of compounding or cascading trust in organizations. Mm. And I'm sure this ties into a lot of your work, Ashley, which is so many times HR systems and functions are built to serve all of the individuals in the middle to bottom of the organization, and executive leaders kind of get a hall pass, right? Mm. But if you've got executive leaders that aren't taking those moments to check in on signals and build trust with their next level leaders, then the reality is that you are hollowing out the kind of the marble jar continuum in your organization. So I would imagine when you come in and find a leader who's embracing this work, that they get kind of a ripple effect through the organization if they lead and set that role model.
Yeah, totally. It makes such a difference to have these behaviors start at the very, very top. You know, that hall pass mentality doesn't stop. Like, let's say if the C-suites, the hall passers, like their next level also thinks they get a hall pass.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's actually, you bring up Brené, and when she does her Dare to Lead work in organizations, she will not say yes to that work unless it's total buy-in at the top level. And buy-in not just being like, yes, we approve this to be funded, but buy-in meaning full participation. Full participation. That is a non-negotiable, and it's a very smart one because she does entire organizational change. She's working with huge enterprises across the enterprise, you know, trying to really create transformation. So anybody, no matter, you know, if you're trying to make a change around leadership or you're changing your operating system or you are leading an acquisition, like all of those changes, there needs to be that participation and that buy-in, not just in a performative way, but really in an emotional way.
Yes.
In order for it to be successful.
I love that.
Stay
with that theme. Let's say you're working with an organization and there's a leader who's fully emotionally bought in, following the work that needs to be done. And then, as we see often in teams, there's a change out. That leader gets a better job offer, they retire, and a new leader comes in. And you've got a whole team that has an operating system, a way of working, but the new leader doesn't subscribe. Like, how do those moments show up in the teams that you've seen? And what are some tips or approaches to prevent that kind of, you know, new leader sabotage of all of that work that a team might have done for 6, 12 months, 3 years, whatever it might be?
Yeah. It's interesting. I'm working with an organization where this is happening in real time. And one of the things that's really important, and we do a lot of work around this, is it's a polarity. And how do you manage as a leader the need to be like strong, meaning like confident, you know your stuff, you're experienced, you're there for a reason, right? How do you balance that with also being really open and humble and growth mindset oriented and show up in occupying both of those things? Because nobody wants the leader who shows up and is like totally like, I don't really know why I'm here. I don't really have much to offer. You all, like, we need to be led, right? But we also don't want the leader who comes in hot and they have their agenda and what they're going to do. And it's challenging, especially when you're talking. I work a lot with very senior leaders. When they're brought in, they're brought in to make a change, right?
Yeah.
And they have a certain amount of time and a lot of eyes on them to make that change. And what you often see is this kind of this like overemphasis on their agenda, their change, their expertise, because they're under that pressure. And so it really has to be something that that leader has committed to, like, okay, I understand how I'm going to kind of balance these two ways of being, and that they're keeping themselves accountable to that. I also think that it doesn't happen enough. And this could be the scenario that you just gave with a new leader coming in. It could be just shifting teams and relationships in general, which happens all the time, where we don't take the time to talk about the relationship. And we just dive into the work. And then all the relationship crap, for lack of a better word, starts to surface and impedes the work. And again, going back to that quote, we're emotional beings, right? Like, the relationships are driving the work on a team. And when you have healthy, functional relationships, you're going to be able to do really great work. It doesn't mean you're not going to ever have points of tension, but you're going to be able to work through those points of tension really effectively and more quickly. And so it's really critical to take some time when you come into a new team or a new team gets formed and talk about things like trust. Talk about things like, what do you need from me? Here's what I need from you. How do I know when you're overwhelmed and stressed? What's okay, what's not okay on this team? You know, setting some of those relational kind of boundaries, those relational expectations. I'm telling you, if more leaders and teams took that time, that they would save themselves so much headache and, you know, stall down the road.
I think that's absolutely, We've done, Jenna and her team, that leader, do a lot of new leader assimilations, which I think do go into not just how work gets done, but, you know, building the footings of good relationships. Because you're right, work is so relational. And it's more than traditional onboarding.
Way more. We used to do an activity building a conflict protocol, which was always very cool, and like really helping teams to understand different approaches to conflict and kind of different triggers, and then like collectively deciding how that how they wanted to approach conflict. And it was really empowering. It was really, it in and of itself was a trust building activity because you got to know one another. It was, you know, building of psychological safety. So it was, fascinating to see what,
and that protocol could be applied across functions, different types of problem sets. That's very cool. I wonder how AI is playing into that now, Ashley, because I've been using Aptiv Index to kind of, which has got a native AI in it, and to say, hey, you know, Jenna and I, or Kurt and I, are having this tension in our work. I'm not going to declare it as a conflict yet, but we've got this tension in our work, and I'm perceiving it this way. What questions might I ask to get curious here? And it's doing a really good job of saying, well, Kurt sees the world in this way and you see the world in that way. So some blind spots or tension points may exist here and here and here. And that's super helpful if you've got an overarching sort of conflict protocol to be able to then lean into some of the AI and the other tooling that, that we now have to create more awareness, knowledge of each other.
I think it's a fantastic tool for that purpose. I've also heard of people using it like for hard conversations. You know, I have to give this person some tough feedback, and what do I want to take into consideration? How might I want to frame this? And I think it's fantastic for that, especially because it's like, it's in the moment, right? So I do a lot of executive coaching. I try to make myself very available to my clients and think I do a very good job, but I'm not, you know, omni-available all the time. Like, and so if that person is going into that conversation in the next 5 minutes, that's a great tool for them. I think where it can lack a bit is just, you know, kind of typical AI in depth. Again, like, we are complex as human beings. And so having a method for better understanding, like, why is it that I am constantly avoiding these hard conversations? Like, yeah, that was really helpful for me to be able to give Dane that feedback right now. But, you know, if I look at my leadership as a whole, I really do a great job at avoiding all these conversations. And what is that about? And, you know, a really skilled, trained, experienced coach can hear things that aren't being said. They can hear like an undertone to what you're saying. They can challenge you in different ways.
Yeah.
That you don't get from AI. But I think it's hugely valuable for use cases like you just shared or the one that I talked about.
And then if you try it, you can always bring it back to your real coach later and say,
yeah,
hey, I had this moment of tension. I came up with these questions using AI. I delivered it in this way. And then you guys can pick it apart and say, well, maybe, maybe you're a little bit triggered in the way you delivered it. Maybe that was this or that or the other.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. I mean, one of my jobs as a coach, I find, is to like be able to say the things to my coachees that nobody else will say.
Yeah.
Especially those, you know, those high level senior leaders. Like, I will tell you if you are being egotistical. I will tell you if you're being, you know, whatever it is. And that's my job. And I don't know that we're quite there yet with that type of relationship with AI.
But
there are certain things that with my clients, I'll be like, yeah, why don't you take it to AI and see what ideas you can come up with in there? So there's certainly a lot of use cases when you think about like how to manage some of the complexities that come with leadership or that come with change, that come with managing relationships and teams. There's a lot of support to be found in AI. I think, again, it's just about being thoughtful about what you're using it for and being a bit discerning. Like, do I need to dig in a little bit more here?
Yeah. Well, I love this conversation today, Ashley, from like just that kind of overwhelming volume of burnout that we're seeing in the world, largely as a result of these constant change. Not moments, constant change kind of programs, cycles, avalanches, whatever you want to call them. I really love the quote that we're emotional beings that think sometimes, and the need therefore to provision some time, space, and skills for seeing people, valuing them, hearing them, and that was such a great call out. Like, before you move to coach, have the empathy and validate that. So that they're not squashed and they get their moment and then you move into the work. I thought that was awesome. I thought it's a great tip for any leader out there that might be getting challenged with some of their team members to think about what emotions that they have trouble dealing with first, because that kind of creates an awareness of maybe one of your weak spots or developmental areas. And I love the conversation on, you know, building trust through those small signals, small moments, that jar of marbles. So there's so much there that leaders can be getting on with in their teams. And if you think about the leaders that are doing those things, well, how are you seeing that show up in their teams? What type of outcomes are you seeing in the teams over the course of time or key projects?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is that they create teams where people want to be and not just be like a butt in a seat, but where they really want to be, you know, where they really want to contribute. They want to have an impact. And because those leaders have created such a space where those folks know that they can contribute, push back, challenge, ask questions, mess up, fail, like that they get more out of people in that way. Yeah. And it becomes kind of like this flywheel where people then get motivated by that contribution. And then the leaders getting more innovation and creativity and productivity. And it's a really beautiful, a beautiful thing to witness and to be a part of if you've ever been a part of it. It's just very life-giving.
Yeah. I love life-giving too, because then that's what takes me back to this whole healthy team concept. The work is great, but also then when you go home from work, you can bring a lot of that life-giving energy to all those other important people that you get the chance to spend your life with.
Absolutely.
Neat. Well, Ashley, for anyone who wants to find you or Ezra Sage, how do they reach out?
Yeah. Our website is EzraSageCo.com. You can also find me on LinkedIn, Ashley Anderson with an S-E-N. That's my Danish roots. And I have an MSW at the end of my name if I get confused with any other Ashley Andersons out there. So Ashley Anderson, MSW on LinkedIn or EzraSageCo.com.
Awesome. Well, thanks again for your time today, Ashley. That was a blast.
Thanks, Dane.
Just a quick note before we go. The views and opinions shared in this episode are those of our guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the host, Dane Gruneveld, the Leader Group, our patron Huddle 3, or our partners and affiliates. Any scenarios discussed are for the purpose of fueling creative thinking and conversation and should be viewed only in this context. Dane, Leader, our sponsors, partners, and affiliates do not endorse any guest or any organization they may be associated with. It's important to remember that every workplace is as individual as the people within it. Our recommendation is to always seek solutions that are specifically designed to help serve your team's unique needs. And to this point, please know we're here, ready to help you find the best way forward, no matter where your starting point is. You can connect with Dane or myself, Alicia McCraw, on LinkedIn or via the links contained in the show notes. Thanks again for tuning in. And hey, if you think someone in your network would benefit from this episode, feel free to share it or give us a 5-star rating. Those 5 little stars really help us reach more curious people like you. We'll catch you next time on the Future of Teamwork.